a factual data creation facility production.
Recorded live at the studios of the Factual Data Creation Facility, it's the OFNT Podcast. Now here's your host, the man who actually knows what a woman is, Jim Schaefer.
And I'm still shell-shocked by that knowledge. Welcome to episode 283, which I'm calling Made by Google Native Ad. Yeah, Google decided to go in a different direction regarding their latest event. More about this later. Well, how does my voice sound? Listeners thought it sounded very different during the intro to the last episode. Hopefully it's back to normal. I've got a pretty good episode for you this week, at least I think so. So sit back and enjoy it if you can. This week's featured microphone is the legendary Electrovoice RE20. Well, let's get started now.
Okay.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
Tech news.
I suppose we're starting with the usual Apple news, are we?
No, I'm starting with Google news this week.
What?
And that's because Google held its Made by Google event last week. Many described the format used for the event as cringe, and sadly, I have to agree with them. Comedian and late-night talk show host Jimmy Fallon hosted the event, and to be honest, he looked like he didn't want to be there. It's as if Mr. Fallon was a substitute for the originally scheduled host who backed out at the last minute. There were appearances by some not-so-known celebrities like the flamboyant Peloton cycling instructor Cody Rigsby.
Who?
Yeah, unless you're in the Peloton ecosystem, you wouldn't have any idea who he is. Let's just say that he's one of my least favorite instructors. We also had a guest appearance by the host of the Call Her Daddy podcast, Alex Cooper, who talked about herself for 5 minutes, barely mentioning the product at hand. The whole production came off like a 90s infomercial for the Thighmaster. That aside, let's get to the point of the event, the products Google was attempting to announce.
Thank you.
I'm not going to go deep into the specs of all the products here.
Thank you.
You could find a better source for those elsewhere. As I've said in the past, I'm a fan of the design of the recent Pixel phones, and I'm not alone. Proof being that none other than Apple has borrowed heavily from the Pixel for the company's upcoming iPhone 17 lineup, especially the camera bar. This year, there were very few changes to the current Pixel design. I mean, why mess with a good thing? The Pixel 10 Pro XL features a 6.8-inch display.
Whoa!
And improves the peak brightness over last year's Pixel 9 Pro XL. Of course, the software, mainly Gemini AI, is improved. And to be fair, Google didn't let Gemini dominate the event as it did in years past. The cameras were slightly upgraded, but that too is to be expected. Battery size has also been increased, which is always a good thing, and Qi2 charging has been added. I think it's pronounced Qi. The Qi2 standard is the industry's answer to Apple's MagSafe, and Apple products are also compatible with that standard. I feel the real improvement for the Pixel lineup this year will be the TSMC-made Tensor G5 chip, manufactured using the 3mm process. This should result in more stable processing with less throttling due to thermal issues. The Pixel Pro XL has 16 gigs of RAM, the same as last year's XL model. The base model includes 256 gigs of storage, comes in 4 different colors, and will set you back $1,200. The Pixel 10 Pro, the model I would personally buy, has all the features of the XL with a slightly smaller battery and but a 6.3-inch display. The base model storage starts at 128 gigs and will cost you $1,000. The regular Pixel 10 has a 6.3-inch display with a lower 1080p resolution, but most people, including myself, probably wouldn't be able to easily tell the difference between it and the 1280p screen of the XL. This poor person's Pixel 10 model comes with 12 gigs of RAM versus the 16 gigs the Pro models come with, and the cameras aren't as high-end as the Pro Pixels. Would you notice this in real-world use? Most likely not. Google actually added a third camera to the Pixel 10, a 10.8 megapixel 5x telephoto lens shooter, something Apple never did with its base model iPhone. Also, the Pixel 10 has the same Tensor G5 chip as the Pro series, and that's another thing Apple doesn't do for its base model iPhone. The base model Pixel 10 comes with 256 gigs of storage and will cost you $800, which really isn't a bad deal these days.
So why wouldn't you personally purchase this base model Pixel 10 over the Pixel 10 Pro?
Well, I had the occasion to actually handle the Pixel 10 Pro XL, the 10 Pro, and the regular Pixel 10 while at a T-Mobile store last Thursday. I found the XL model too large and the base model Pixel 10's construction lacking that solid feel I prefer. The regular size Pixel Pro 10 was just the right size and had a solid feel to it. It looks and feels like a modern iPhone, which I'll detail more in the Tech I'm Using section.
Wait, you didn't wind up buying a Pixel 10 Pro, or did you?
No, I didn't buy one, especially with the one whom must be obeyed present at the time. I'm not knocking the regular Pixel 10 here. I'm just saying that if I were in the market for a new Pixel phone, and I'm not, and I could afford the extra $200 that the Pro would cost, well, I'd choose that model. Now, if I couldn't afford the Pixel 10 Pro, I'd gladly buy the regular Pixel 10. Google also introduced the Google Pixel Fold, which, while on display at the T-Mobile store, I didn't have a chance to get my hands on it. Anyway, at this point, I'm just not that interested in the foldable form factor. The Fold has 16 gigs of RAM and 256 gigs of base storage, a slightly larger 6.4-inch outboard screen, a larger battery, and improved water and dust resistance. The price? $1,800 of your hard-earned dollars. And that's just too much money for my taste. The price of foldable phones are what's keeping this form factor niche.
Yes.
Moving along, the Google Pixel Buds 2A were shown. They'll cost $130, but can't be compared feature-wise with the more expensive AirPods Pro from Apple. And finally, the Google Pixel Watch 4 was shown with a better display, upgraded chipset, improved fitness tracking, and a different charging method. The 41mm watch starts at $350, and the larger 45mm model starts at $399. LTE connectivity is available for both models at an additional cost. While I'm intrigued with a round-shaped smartwatch, I think the squarish shape of the Apple Watch is more practical. All in all, it was more of a refinement year for Google, with no radical hardware design changes. Google put more effort into the Android Material UI this year.
It's gorgeous.
Nah, Google describes it as being fantastic and beautiful. 9to5Google.com is reporting that the just-announced Pixel 10 lineup will be the first smartphones to support satellite voice and video calls through the WhatsApp messaging app. This should give the new Pixel models a leg up over the iPhone in Europe, where I've heard WhatsApp rules over all competing messaging apps. In Asia, especially Southeast Asia, Facebook Messenger is king, and being Meta owns and operates both of these messaging apps, well, it wouldn't surprise me if we saw an announcement that the Pixel 10 lineup also supports satellite voice and video calls from Messenger too. My question is, how much will this cost the consumer? I'm pretty sure satellite communication doesn't come cheap. In another article from 9to5google.com, which quotes Bloomberg.com, which had a recent sit-down with the Big G's chief design officer, that we should expect Pixel redesigns every 2 to 3 years, with no plans for a flip phone, and that the company's tablet plans are on pause. Well, a 2 to 3 year gap in phone design is understandable. And let's face it, the market for a flip phone is presently minuscule. But the tablet market is something I have thought Google would be very interested in. Especially when Google just announced that Chrome OS and Android would be combined into one entity. The CDO went on to say that the company will not be making a tablet until they find a, quote, meaningful future, unquote, for the category. He was also quoted as saying that the Pixel phone will never be a giant player in the smartphone market, so the priority is the Android mobile operating system. Well, I don't know about you, but after reading this and Google's propensity of just discontinuing products out of the blue, I'm sort of dissuaded from buying Google-made hardware. What strange things to say during an interview. While Google seems to be uninterested in the Android tablet market, it seems that Amazon is willing to pick up the slack. According to an article from AndroidAuthority.com, Amazon is working on a higher-end Android tablet codenamed Kitty Hawk.
Oh, I get it. As in the Wright brothers.
This rumored tablet will run real Android, not some forked version of it, and come in at a price of around $400. That's kind of expensive for Amazon, but compared to an iPad, it still would be reasonable. Depending on the features, that is. No details on the specifications were revealed, but at that cost, I'd expect them to compare to Samsung's tablet line. If done correctly, I can see this Amazon tablet shaking up the Android tablet market. Well, time will tell. Various news outlets are reporting that chipmaker Intel has agreed to sell the United States government a 10% stake in their business. Now I understand why Trump has had a problem with Intel's current CEO, who has some kind of communist Chinese ties. I also understand why Intel would agree to letting the government buy a stake in their company. That's because the once king of chip foundries is steadily bleeding capital, has become a shadow of what it once was. What I don't understand is why the government wants a stake in Intel in the first place. Could this be in order to head off any foreign purchase of Intel in the future? Or could it be that future combat drones will sport the Intel Inside sticker on them? You tell me. Weird times we're living in. If you're a steady listener to this podcast, heck, even if you're not, then you'd know about the giant fruit company's problem with a little firm named Masimo over patents for blood oxygen monitoring sensors. Back in 2023, Masimo even managed to get a judgment against Apple, which prohibits them from selling Apple Watches with blood oxygen monitoring capability within the United States. Recently, Apple announced an end to this restriction, which sees blood monitoring calculated not on the watch itself, but on the iPhone. Yeah, a bit of dirty pool there, if you ask me. According to 9to5Mac.com, in response to this development, Masimo is suing U.S. Customs, which in reality doesn't exist. It's been since renamed Customs and Border Protection, claiming that the CBP overstepped its authority and violated due process by allowing Apple to restore the feature. To add insult to injury, Masimo says it only found out about the decision when Apple announced the return of the feature. Masimo is asking for a temporary restraining order and an injunction to block CBP's decision, thus reinstating the original ruling. While I would like to see blood oxygen monitoring make a return to Apple Watches, Masimo has a good point here. In order to process the results of blood oxygen monitoring on an iPhone, Apple has to first use the Apple Watch's sensors to obtain that data, and the sensors' technology patents are what the original rulings were based upon. Unfortunately for Apple, I think Masimo's latest lawsuit will be successful, and Apple will have to remove the workaround. I think this whole issue could be resolved with a boatload of money. If Apple winds up losing this new lawsuit, perhaps that boatload of cash will finally depart the port of Cupertino and set sail towards Masimo. The iPhone 17e is rumored to finally leave the notch behind, is the headline from AppleInsider.com, quoting a leaker from Chinese social media platform Weibo. The leaker claims that the iPhone 17e, which is predicted to be released in May of next year, will still have a 6.1-inch display with a these-days-paltry 60Hz screen refresh rate. But replace the controversial front screen camera notch with a dynamic island.
Yay!
And of course, the 17e will also get the latest and greatest A19 chip. being that the iPhone 16e replaced the SE, with both models based on older versions of iPhones, well, this kind of makes sense. 16e is based on the iPhone 14, so the 17e can conceivably be based on the iPhone 15 or maybe 16 series of iPhones. If this all pans out, the E series of iPhones have taken one step further to becoming my iPhone of choice. Just add a 120Hz screen refresh rate and I'm sold. Tech I'm using. Well, more like tech I've given. Last episode, I had a teaser about a new piece of tech coming to the OFNT household. Well, my son John celebrated a birthday last Tuesday, and I bought him an iPhone 16e, along with a MagSafe case for the occasion. The 16e will replace the iPhone SE he's been using for 3 or more years now. While he loved the SE, that model won't be getting many of the cool iOS 26 features coming in September, and iOS 26 will most likely be the last operating system update his 2022 SE will receive. Because of the age of the SE, we had to go to the closest T-Mobile store, which is about a 40-minute drive, believe it or not, in order to get the new 16E activated on their network. This also gave me the opportunity to have a hands-on with the new Google Pixel 10 series of phones, which the T-Mobile store already had on display, which I considered an added bonus. My impressions of the Pixel 10 were in the tech news section, of course. My first impressions of the iPhone 16e were mostly positive. Like the Pixel 10, the design of the 16e is clean and very nice in my opinion. In fact, except for the Pixel's camera bar, the phones could be mistaken for one another while viewing them from the rear. The 16e is very light compared to my iPhone 15 Pro Max, but of course it would be. The last poor person's iPhone that I carried around was the iPhone 13. That too was very light, but didn't feel as solid as the 16e does. And my favorite iPhone of all time was the 2011 iPhone 4S, mostly because of its solid feel. The 16e reminds me of the 4S in this regard, and also the aforementioned clean design. The OLED screen of the 16e is bright enough for most conditions, except outside in bright sunlight, but those conditions only occur randomly for this family, due to our lifestyle. We're not the outdoorsy types. The phone is snappy and I could tell no difference in speed between my 15 Pro and the 16e. My son hasn't gotten around to taking any photos with his new phone yet, but I'm pretty sure the results will be better than the Gen 3 SE he's been using. As is known, the 16e still has the notch instead of the dynamic island on its display, but for normal use, the notch is just fine. Now, I still prefer the dynamic island, but most users, including my son, probably don't care about that. The 16e features a 6.1-inch OLED display versus the 4.7 LCD screen of the SE. Though the screen is much larger, the 16e as a whole is only a little over a quarter inch larger than the SE. Another thing the 16e doesn't have is the MagSafe feature. I don't know why Apple didn't just throw this in, because all MagSafe is basically is a magnet. The inexpensive MagSafe case I purchased along with the phone fits perfectly, and I tested the MagSafe case with the 16e enclosed within it on one of my MagSafe charging stations, and it worked perfectly.
But isn't the actual wireless charging speed much slower on the iPhone 16e than regular iPhones?
MagSafe-equipped phones can wirelessly charge at up to 15 watts, while the 16e can only charge at 7.5 watts. But realistically, the battery life of the 16e can last a full day of normal use, meaning most users will charge their phones overnight while they sleep. 7.5 watts should be more than adequate to fully charge the phone in that period of time. Besides the upgraded camera, larger display, and the A18 chip, the base 16e has 128 gigabytes of storage, which is double the amount of the old SE. There are many more improvements over the SE, and I feel the extra $170 you'd spend on a 16e are well worth it. You get a thoroughly modern iPhone, but stripped of the features most users don't use anyway. As I reported in the tech section, next year's iPhone 17e display might feature a dynamic island instead of a notch. When this E-series of iPhones get a 120Hz screen refresh rate ProMotion display, well, I can see myself opting for this phone series instead of the Pro versions I find myself carrying around now. My phone use case has changed since I retired from working life. I'm not out and about as much these days, and I'm seldom out of reach of a larger screened Apple device if needed. Besides, this would give me an excuse to upgrade my current Apple Watch to an Apple Watch Ultra.
You are a sneaky devil, aren't you?
So I've been told. Many of the iPhone's features are rumored to be coming to the Ultra series of watches real soon now. I'll be purchasing another iPhone 16e this fall.
Autumn.
Right, autumn, for my eldest daughter's birthday. I'm sure she'll be quite happy with it. She was using an iPhone XR.
What?
Until recently, but unfortunately, it was stolen.
New York's New York. All crime.
So what's your take on the iPhone 16e? Entertainment news. I treat mainstream news outlets as entertainment these days, and yes, that includes Fox News. Instead of fact-based reporting, the overwhelming majority of these operations instead use opinion or agenda-based reporting. I noticed this starting to happen during the mid-1980s, but this phenomenon accelerated during the Obama years and the amending of the Smith-Mund Act of 2012. The original act of 1948 forbid broadcasters from disseminating propaganda within the United States. This so-called Smith-Mund Modernization Act of 2012 ended that propaganda restriction.
Now, why would the powers that be do this?
My best guess would be to control the narrative, as the cool kids say.
No!
Also contributing to this agenda-based reporting is a shift in the type of person becoming a journalist these days. Previously, a journalist's job was considered a semi-blue-collar job. Over time, this has shifted to journalists being Ivy League college-educated. Instead of teaching basic journalism, these J-schools are pumping out leftist activists instead of journalists, who consider their primary job as to be changing society to their particular ideology instead of reporting actual facts. And I don't need to tell you what that ideology is.
Welcome, comrade.
If you watch the mainstream news and have half a brain, this shift will be readily apparent to you. Another shift over the years is that news reporting was considered a public service. Now the news has become a profit-driven enterprise, hence the endless pharmaceutical advertisements during these news broadcasts.
Wasn't Kennedy supposed to put an end to pharmaceutical advertisements?
Yes, that was one of the promises made during the election cycle. Perhaps he'll eventually get around to fulfilling that promise. We can only hope. The public at large finally started becoming aware of this change around 2016, and some even started keeping an eye on the news industry. Video montages of reporters from widely different news organizations mouthing the same exact talking points started appearing on YouTube and podcasts regularly. The whole COVID thing exposed this situation fully. One of the most odious of news organizations,
CNN?
No, MSNBC, lovingly referred to as MSDNC, the DNC standing for Democratic National Committee by many, has just introduced a new name and logo as they prepare to spin off from NBC News. MSNBC launched as a joint venture between NBC News and Microsoft back in 1996. It was supposed to be a way for the younger generations to get their news in a cool and hip way. While Microsoft divested their interest in MSNBC in 2012, and the channel became closely associated with NBC News, morphing into a channel with mostly opinion-based content, which was once known as an editorial. In fact, news programs would announce that the upcoming content was the opinion of the station, not factual news.
Yeah, those days are long gone.
They sure are. By the 2000s, MSNBC had shifted to broadcasting opinion-based news reporting exclusively. Never really competitive, the network got an audience boost in 2016 after the election of President Trump. MSNBC, along with the once great CNN, became the, quote, resistance news networks and broadcast their hate for Trump 24/7. MSNBC was best known at this time as being the top purveyors of the since-disproven Russiagate hoax, constantly making allegations, which were never proven, that the newly elected Trump was an agent of Russia. After the election of President Biden,
what am I doing here?
MSNBC became a cheerleader for the then-new president and his Democratic Party as a whole. In the lead-up to the 2024 national elections, MSNBC became so toxic towards Trump and his supporters that even many of their regular viewers were turned off. When Trump was re-elected, instead of another bump in audience numbers like in 2016, viewership dropped some 40%. NBC News itself, hemorrhaging money, wanted nothing to do with MSNBC and its toxic reputation, so it was decided to spin off the now low-rated news outlet. This after the firing of a number of the network's most toxic news readers, resident racist Joy Reid being the most infamous. Well, last week, MSNBC was renamed to MS Now, which stands for My Source News Opinion World.
Huh?
Exactly. At least the new title accurately contains the word news opinion, because that's all this channel is. News opinion, not news facts. The new logo looks like it was created by ChatGPT. It features MS Now on a red, white, and blue background, the colors of the U.S. flag, but of course, this background doesn't really resemble the nation's flag. Heaven forbid the new logo resemble our nation's flag. That would be a sin against the ideology of the place. Predictions are dour from other media outlets for the future of MS Now. Without the resources of NBC News, many predict that MS Now will slowly fade away. And in my opinion, it couldn't happen to a worse news channel. Another week, another streaming service price increase. This time, it's Apple TV Plus's turn to increase its monthly subscription price. Starting on August 21st, subscribers will pay $12.99 per month. And that's up from $9.99 per month.
What?
That's a $3 per month price increase.
Oh no, why?
Apple TV launched in 2019 for $4.99 per month, which was a bargain, though there wasn't much to watch on the new service. Big money deal with Oprah Winfrey and PBS didn't help bring in more subscriptions. But over the years, Apple has built up a nice stable of original movies and television series. In 2022, Apple increased subscription prices to $6.99 per month. Then in 2024, increased this price to $9.99. This after adding MLB baseball and professional soccer to its lineup. Speaking of which, it appears Apple is out of the bidding process for Sunday Night Baseball and might even jettison its current Friday Night Baseball. Well, with the subpar announcers Apple has for Friday Night Baseball, nobody's probably watching it, unless their favorite team happens to be playing. Anyway, the only good news here is that Apple One Plan subscribers, which bundles together various Apple services, Apple TV being one of them, will not see this price increase in their monthly bill. Yet. As I've said before, these streaming prices are getting totally out of control. I recently canceled my Peacock subscription and even got rid of a lot of app subscriptions I had. I'm sure I'm not alone in doing this either.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Podcast news. I know that I had promised not to talk about audio interfaces in the last episode.
Are you saying that you're breaking that promise?
Yes and no. This is just a short update, not a full-blown thing. I had complained of a hissing noise in the headphone output of my new audio interface. Well, again, this was due to a software setting that I eventually figured out, which solved the issue. Overall, I was pleased with the audio of episode 282, except for the intro where my voice sounded different for some reason, most likely due to post-processing software. So this should be my last report on audio interfaces until I decide on my final choice of one.
Thank you.
Another list of the best podcasts in the world has dropped, this time from Left of Dial. The name of the organization accurately foretells its bias. Of the 100 or so podcasts listed, I'd only heard of 17 of them, had listened to only 7 of them, and actually liked but 3 of them. The list was populated by the usual suspects, you know, those produced by NPR, The New York Times, etc. The shows on this list that I actually listened to were The Joe Rogan Experience.
Huh?
Yeah, though included this time was tied for last place.
That figures.
Pivot.
Welcome, comrade.
Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, Wolf 359, and Welcome to Night Vale.
It's fabulous, that is, if you're into that lifestyle.
WTF and This American Life, which was rated as the number one podcast of all time. The only podcasts on that list that I actually liked enough to listen more than once were The Joe Rogan Experience, Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, and my favorite that made the list, Wolf 359. Most of the other shows on the list are better suited for those of the highly educated class, if you get my drift.
Yes.
I think the Podcast Listeners Awards are happening soon. That's run by the CEO of the Blueberry Podcast Hosting Service. And that's the list I can more identify with. The music is playing as episode 283 of the OFNT podcast becomes part of podcasting history. Hope you enjoyed this episode. I enjoyed making it for you. If you like what you heard, you can make a donation using the link in the show notes. Any and all donations will be greatly appreciated. You can always reach me at ofntpodcast@gmail.com, and that's if you're so inclined. I'd enjoy hearing from you. Remember, don't listen to what they say. Watch what they do. I realize that there's still no gates on my fence, but I still want you to get off my lawn. Stay skeptical. I'm out.
See ya.
And that, folks, is the end of the show.